For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. This podcast is recorded and produced on the lands of the Djabal and Djerriwarr peoples. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, their elders past, present and emerging. Before we begin today, a warning. We will be talking about a sensitive subject. Gender-based violence cuts across all communities, and the health and medical community is no exception. If you don't feel ready to listen to this discussion, we suggest that this episode might not be for you. If this topic raises issues for you, we recommend the services of 1800 Respect. Other resources and links are available in the show notes to this podcast. My special guest today is Professor Kelsey Hegarty, an academic GP and Joint Chair of Family Violence Prevention at the University of Melbourne and the Royal Women's Hospital. She leads the NHMRC Safer Family Centre of Research Excellence and co-chairs the Melbourne Research Alliance to End Violence Against Women. Kelsey and her colleagues have written a narrative review for the MJA on transforming health settings to address gender-based violence in Australia. It is open access and available at mja.com.au. The full link is in the show notes. Thanks, Kelsey. You and your colleagues have written a narrative review for the MJA on gender-based violence and what health systems need to change in order to provide the right support. How do we define gender-based violence? What does it include?
So gender-based violence includes intimate partner violence and sexual violence and other harmful acts that are directed at people based on their gender. And the ones that I mentioned, intimate partner violence and sexual violence, are usually by men against women, but obviously people of all genders can perpetrate or can experience. And particularly we know that people from non-binary genders experience quite a lot of abuse and violence.
Do we have good data about what the prevalence is in Australia at the moment?
So we have a national survey called the Personal Safety Survey, and from that we can get good figures on domestic or intimate partner violence. And 1 in 6 women and 1 in 17 men experience that, so it's obviously gendered. And sexual violence occurs 1 in 6 women and 1 in 25 men. It's quite prevalent in the community.
Tell me about the Indigenous numbers.
It's very sad indictment on our country that Indigenous women's experiences are, some estimates are 35 to 80 times higher than the national average. And that isn't always by Indigenous partners, that can be by non-Indigenous partners. So it's really, as we write in the article, a result of colonialism and patriarchy and discrimination against Indigenous women and girls.
Is there a socioeconomic factor in those numbers?
It's across all socioeconomic groups, but we do know that poverty is associated with that. And in fact, just in the last week, Anne Summers has brought out an article that shows that particularly for single mothers who obviously are often poverty, that domestic violence is extraordinarily high as well. Yeah. So that factor of not managing well on your income and being very poor is associated.
Apart from the obvious immediate consequences of violence, what are the long-term consequences for victims, survivors, if the situation doesn't change, if they're, you know, they don't receive treatment or they don't somehow get out of the situation they're in?
I think that when we're talking about violence, we need to make sure that we're not thinking physical violence and injuries, because in fact, victim survivors say that the emotional abuse or psychological violence is the most damaging. And the World Health Organization categorizes it as, obviously there's direct results of physical or sexual violence on physical matters, but the psychological trauma and coercion and control creates fear and trauma in the body and obviously can result in mental health effects. So extraordinary association on systematic review evidence with mental health issues, but also accumulated over a lifetime that can then result in chronic diseases later in life.
My impression from what I've read and what I've experienced is that the health service is where people go first. Is that fair?
They're the first professional who are often told, and we know that from that same national study, but family and friends are who they go to first. and then they go to health professionals. And it is only later on that often in their journeys to help seeking that they end up contacting the police or the justice system and getting involved with that. So you can see that a health system, particularly universal health systems such as general practice, they're very key to stopping the trajectory of harm that can happen from ongoing domestic violence and sexual violence. So it's the idea that it's early engagement. We could engage early, and that will also prevent the effect on children. Because if children are growing up in these families where, you know, where the male partner is showing coercive control and physical and sexual violence towards the partner, the children are aware of this going on, and it impacts on them because they're walking on eggshells as well in a household. Some of the prevention activities that are happening are great, like respectful relationships in school, but if they're going home to houses where this is occurring, health can try and intervene with the, you know, or work with the parents to stop this happening, to prevent it then affecting the children. So I see that as early intervention.
If health practitioners are perfectly placed to be on the front line of this response, are we doing it? What are the barriers to health practitioners making those early interventions?
So there's many barriers to health practitioners, and we at Safer Family Centre have synthesised the qualitative studies where we have looked at global studies about what stops health practitioners. And they're at the personal level and the structural level. Personally, they feel like they can't interfere in a private matter, or they see it as, they don't almost see it as a health issue. So therefore it's a social issue, even though it's got this huge burden of disease, particularly for childbearing women. And if they do feel like they could ask about it in a sensitive way, they're then feeling a bit overwhelmed because they feel like it doesn't make any difference and they don't have any control over it, because if they're talking to the survivor, it's actually the person using the violence who's the person, whose behaviour it is, not the survivors. And so it can feel a bit frustrating for them and overwhelming because they can't control any outcome at all. The third thing is that they do see it as a social worker's role or someone else's role or the justice role or the police, you know, because that's what they see in the media about the role of those people. So they worry that there's nothing they can offer and therefore don't do it. But at a structural level, often the environment works against us. Imagine a busy emergency department, curtains, and general practice is pretty optimally placed because they at least have some time and resources, but even they feel pushed for time. And they just feel often that they don't have a team behind them. So hospitals might have the team, but not the environment. General practice has the privacy and but doesn't have a team. And then there's some health practitioners are the same as other people. They have negative attitudes around this area.
Is there a generational thing at work there too? Are younger doctors engaging more in this?
That might be the case, but it's still, you know, in the community attitude survey, we have some negative attitudes across the spectrum, including by men and women. Certainly men hold more negative attitudes against women than women do. But, you know, it really is still concerning that young people often have some still negative attitudes, particularly around sexual violence, that a woman who's drunk is not and gets raped, that they have negative attitudes about that and blame the woman. Yeah. So that blaming the victim is common across the population, and including by some selected health practitioners.
So if I'm a GP and I suspect that my patient is in this situation, but she or he hasn't started that conversation, how do I start that conversation?
And look, I think it's an easy conversation to ask. It's within the realms of the health practitioners, but they've never been taught it. We've looked at how much is taught in medical schools, and it's less than 3 hours on average. So compared to something like asthma or diabetes, when this is equally as common and equally a health effect, it's a tragedy that they're not taught. But really, the indicators are really clear and are very common presentations, aren't they? So if I see someone who's depressed or anxious or not sleeping or in chronic pain or has chronic irritable bowel syndrome symptoms or any chronic thing where you think to yourself, oh, I wonder what's going on underneath the surface. Then we train, so Safer Family Centre is training GPs to ask sensitively, and you funnel the questions from how are things at home, and someone might say, fine, you know, oh, we just check about people's relationships in relation to their health. You seem a bit anxious today. What's happening with your relationship? And they might say, oh, things have been a bit of a struggle. You know, so you're funneling down, but then it's good to directly ask. Sometimes yeah. we know that things that are happening in relationships that make one person fearful, you know, are you afraid of your partner? Are you feeling safe at home? So we don't say, are you a domestic violence
No.
because people aren't labelling themselves
yeah.
as such.
Does that conversation shift in different cultural settings, like in an Indigenous patient, for example, or a CALD, you know, a CALD patient? How yes. does that nuance happen?
And I think that's a really important point, because what might mean fearful or safe in English may not mean it in another language. Yeah. And particularly we know for some work that University of Melbourne is doing, that engagement at the Indigenous level involves really making sure that you have a sensitive approach, that you're really thinking through what is going to be appropriate for that person in front of you. And that includes maybe taking more time with rapport, more time making sure that you've established a trusting relationship, making sure that you're able to hold the space. And this is true for anybody, but particularly true for people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds and Indigenous populations. And incorporating, you know, methods of communication gently and indirectly, you might stay at that general funneling questions before you asked a direct question such as, yeah. have you been physically hurt? Or directly might not be an early question you would ask, yeah. and making sure that you can respond and use a strengths-based approach. Look, I think the thing that worries me, though, is people say, oh, you know, I haven't got time to develop the rapport, so I won't ask.
I'm chatting today with Professor Kelsey Hegarty from the Safer Family Centre for Excellence Research. The links to Kelsey's co-authored narrative review, the Safer Family Centre, and other useful resources about gender-based violence are in the show notes to this podcast. If this podcast is raising issues for you, we strongly recommend the excellent services available at 1800 Respect and those at the Safer Family Centre. You can catch up with our back catalogue of episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts, where they are free to access. You can subscribe to upcoming episodes by searching for the Medical Journal of Australia on your favourite podcast platform. It's free to subscribe. Back to our chat. In my conversations with GPs lately, they're having less and less time to establish those rapports.
They're totally swamped at the moment. You know, I'm in a department of general practice. I am a GP. General practitioners are totally swamped by what they've been asked to do for COVID. Yeah. So they're very stressed. But look, a lot of them do this work and a lot of others are interested in doing this work. And I think there's very simple ways of developing trust and rapport. And often GPs know their patients, so they are ideally placed. They know them. And I think that they get a surprise when they ask directly. People who they've known for a long time, it's the reverse. They have a blind spot and don't think about it being, and you know, they might know the partner, they might know the father, you know, and he's a lovely bloke, so they've got unconscious biases in their heads. But I do think, in my experience in practice and in from the evidence, that women find it very acceptable to be asked directly. We've done a large study using the mnemonic ACTS. It's a screening questions, which is afraid, controlled, threatened, and physically hurt. So it's been used in antenatal care and recommended by the Victorian government. And really, those questions are not intrusive, and most women find them acceptable.
So what kind of support can health service providers offer straight away to people in this situation?
So believe them. But the World Health Organization has developed a first response model, which there's videos of me and others doing it in 10 minutes. So you can do something which is very basic about listening. So the mnemonic is lives, listening, inquiring about needs and validating experience. That can actually be done in 10 minutes. Someone listening to you, like you know, you go to the hairdresser and get listened to and it's amazing.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
So you go to your GP and you listen to, and that's what people really value. The trickier bit is the E and S of lives, which is enhancing safety. And offering ongoing support, the last one's easy. So a lot of health practitioners haven't been taught about how to do a risk assessment and a safety assessment and a safety plan. So, but they have been taught that for suicide. They have been taught that to ask sort of risk assessment questions for sexually transmitted infections. So it's within their realm. It's just adding this bit on that says these are the risk factors for more serious domestic violence and sexual violence. And these are the questions you could ask for that.
Talk to me a little bit about trauma-informed care. What does that look like?
Yeah, it's a bandied around word at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And it's in a lot of the policy documents at state and national level in the mental health documents. Mm-hmm. And I think that trauma-informed care is, you know, and I like to call it trauma and violence-informed care, because I find a lot of practitioners think about it in terms of child abuse in the past and not current domestic violence and sexual violence risk. And that's probably what they've been taught in terms of trauma. But actually, people are unsafe and feeling unsafe physically, emotionally, or culturally, or spiritually now. They might have had past experiences and present experiences, but it's now. So when you're thinking about this, I think it's to have the trauma and violence-informed care. Really, that's a set of principles of the safety I was just talking about. But thinking about trust and transparency, so being clear about what patient survivors want to know what's going to happen.
Yes.
They actually would really like to have some peer support programs to be sent to, so that they actually have that lived experience walking alongside them. They want collaboration, so that you're not just suddenly being sent somewhere without them understanding. They want empowerment. They want person-centered care, decision-making and goal-setting. Now, all of these words are already in documents.
Yes.
But to put it into practice where we're really respecting survivors and families and children's experiences and respect for diversity and the structural violence that they might actually be experiencing as well. It's hard to do, but it's what we've got to start doing. And from the moment someone walks into a clinic or a hospital, checking what the intake forms look like, checking how the reception staff talk to them, checking how the waiting room looks. Some of them look appalling. Thinking about having policies where you do see people alone, and that people can be asked, partners and family members can be asked to step out, so that it's normal and it's not just for the survivors. Thinking about what your room is like and where you sit and all those non-verbal things are really important.
I'm assuming a lot of these resources are available at Safer Family Centre on the website.
Yes, so we've got a lot on our website around, and we've got a lot of training material, and we're running in-practice sessions. We've got e-learning modules. We've got webinars. We had a webinar last night on people who use domestic violence, because obviously GPs see those people as well, and
yes,
we need to engage early with them as well.
Yeah.
You know, and we've got how to assist children as well. But 1-800 Respect has got amazing resources, and in each state there is a dedicated domestic violence service. So I won't go through those, but
no, that's
you know, 1-800 Respect is the national one. And look, in terms of trauma, there's really good resources on Blue Knot Foundation, who are one of our partners. And
so in your MJA paper, you also talk about the changes that need to happen at a health system level. What needs to be done there?
Probably a revolution. But,
Excellent.
I mean, I think it's quite difficult, isn't it? Because some of it is we instinctively just do training or something like that. And we know from trying to change behaviours in a system, it's so much more complex than that, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, it's so many things that need to be done. And it starts at the leadership level. If we don't have an environment that's authorizing, so wherever you are, say even at a practice owner or a hospital leadership, we need clinical champions. We need people who can support the practitioners to do the work. We need protocols and referral pathways. We need recurrent training. We need mentoring of the staff and places for them to go for their own experiences, because work we've done has shown that health practitioners have a high prevalence of domestic and sexual violence. But to truly change the system, we need mechanisms for feedback, survivors and from practitioners and from audits. We know in chronic disease models, you know, if we look and see how we're going with diabetes care and we tell the practitioners, I'm not doing as good as this person. What could I do differently? You know, we don't have those mechanisms in place for this. And we need to work strongly with our partners, with the justice system, with the specialist system. But yes, not everybody's going to go there, and probably nor should they, because it's not what some survivors want. They actually want to have someone to walk alongside them as an ally. And yes, health practitioners are very well placed to do that journey with them and to help them navigate the system. Now, that's not saying we don't need the whole system responding. We need the whole community responding.
Of course.
But I really feel that if we put some more elements in place, particularly the audit and feedback, we would be in a better place.
You mentioned earlier that medical students don't get a lot of training in this. Would you like to see that change?
Absolutely, and have been lobbying for a very long time with some others to do that. I think part of the issue is it's self-fulfilling, isn't it? There aren't people who know about it to actually do the training.
Yeah, right.
So we have been doing a train-the-trainer model with a lot of general practitioners to try and upskill people to do this training. And, you know, we've been so lucky to get such dedicated GPs and family violence workers. We're getting them, yes, to train together and to understand each other's silos so that we can have strong linked primary care and family violence. And yes, we need to expand the ability of people at university level to train in this area and for it to be as equal as cancer and diabetes and mental health and, yep, asthma. I think that finally we need urgent further consultation with the voices of Indigenous women and girls. And it's a distinct area. The rates are increasing. We need genuine co-design of solutions. Yes. And there's some excellent Indigenous researchers and health practitioners who are stepping forward, such as Shawana Andrews, who co-wrote. And I think that that's an area that needs resourcing, not words on policy, actually needs resourcing. And the second area is, yeah, sexual violence, which is why Laura Tazia is the other co-author. A lot of sexual violence is within by their partners or a family member. We tend to highlight the stranger rapes, but in fact, that area is even more hidden within domestic violence and, yeah, and needs to really be a distinct area of research and practice.
Thank you.
That's all right.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.